from meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news. Broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. It's always a big kick to have Diane Diamond on the show. You know her, longtime investigative reporter, author, correspondent for Entertainment Tonight, and a very good friend of the program. Good evening, ma'am.
Good evening, Dana. How are you? Thanks for having me back.
I am doing fine. And we want to talk, get started here, and I encourage everyone to go to Diane's webpage. Just click on the link in the show notes. Los Angeles, and that term serial killer has come up, and I've done many, many shows, and I'm sure you've done many, many stories on serial killers. There's a big difference between what a spree killer and a serial killer is. Let's start out right away, Diane. Let's describe and give the definition of what a serial killer is.
Well, according to the FBI, the profilers at the FBI, a serial killer is someone who kills more than three people or more, say. Now, you and I both know, Dana, that serial killers can kill dozens of people, and sometimes their total count is not even known because the bodies are never found.
Sure, sure. The Green River Killer, I think he was called?
Yes, there's a Green River Killer. I mean, I have done so many stories with so many serial killers in my life that, you know, if you added them all up, it's thousands of people who have died. Yeah. You think John Wayne Gacy, you think Ted Bundy, you think the Green River Killer, you think the Hillside Strangler.
Yep.
These are people who authorities knew about. But back in the day, the public was never really aware that there was a serial killer in the midst because the police thought, well, we don't want to panic the public. I see that changing now. And I recently wrote a column about what California police believe is a serial killer in California targeting homeless people. And I was pretty happy to see that they're now publicly talking in terms of serial killers that walk among us, because I believe we have the right to be aware of that and be safe.
If you click on the link in the show notes, you can see that article that Diane has written, America's Serial Killers, How Many? What do you think it was in the past, Diane, and even today, reluctance as far as releasing the story to the public, not wanting to spread panic, you know, the continuity of the investigation? What is it that you think that make the people stay back? I can remember very plainly the Hillside Stranglers, and that, you know, finally they did go media-wise, and that helped catch them. Of course, there were some vigilante things going on then with, what was his name? The guy with the pentagram on his hand.
Charlie Manson.
No. In Los Angeles, he was the...
I know who you're talking about. Ramirez.
Richard Ramirez.
And Richard Ramirez,
that's
yes,
right.
Yes.
And,
you know, I have sat across the interview table from serial killers. I remember interviewing Kenneth Bianchi. He was up in Walla Walla, Washington. I was a young reporter working for the television show Hard Copy. And I thought to myself, well, you know, going into the interview, I thought, well, this is a hardened killer. He's killed, along with his uncle, Angelo
Buono,
whatever his name was,
have
killed all these people. How can I get to the human core of this man? So I let him go on and on for a while the tape rolled, and then I said, talk to me about your son. And Kenneth Bianchi burst into tears. And for some reason, in this psychotic mind who could take a life like that without a second thought, the very question about his son, this life that he had brought into his life, into the world, stopped him dead. And so I guess, I don't know why I bring that up really to you, Dana, except to say I think there is a ounce of humanity in each and every one of these serial killers, but there's something that makes them appear normal, yet not be normal. And that's what I want people to understand when they read my column or when they think about serial killers. We may have hundreds of them operating in America and Canada right now.
Right. Yeah, there's FBI stats.
I just don't know because they appear so normal.
Yeah, the FBI stats that come out, let's talk about that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
I have long talked to the FBI agent, John Douglas, who really set up the profile of a serial killer way back when. He's retired now.
Right.
And I contacted him recently, and I said, how many do you think there are active serial killers in America? And he said, conservatively, between 35 and 50.
Jeez.
I think he's being too conservative.
I think so.
When I talk to other experts who don't want to be named because they are active in the business, they think it's more like in the hundreds or the double hundreds. And so, you know, killing one person, I can't even imagine. But killing two or three or four people to them is nothing. And what they do with the bodies, well, we saw John Wayne Gacy, for example,
sure,
up in the Chicago area. There were, oh gosh, I'm forgetting now, 30 or 40 of his victims buried underneath his house. 40 victims. And finally, when police caught him, I think they were on to him for a while, but when they finally caught him, these 40 families got some relief.
Yeah.
It took a while to identify everybody. One of them was just identified recently. But can you imagine how many John Wayne Gacy's are out there?
Yeah.
How many Ted Bundy's? How many of the bind, torture, kill, the B2K killers are out there? That last gentleman, you know, he was active for 30 years. He would slow down and speed up and slow down and speed up. So I write the columns, Dana, not to freak everybody out, but to just be aware that there are killers that might be living right next door to us.
Diane Diamond's here, and we're talking about her most recent article, America's Serial Killers, How Many? And let's talk about Rader for a minute, the BTK killer, and his taunting of the media and the police, you know, mailing them pieces of identification of the victims, et cetera, et cetera. And we all saw the confession, so to speak, when he was in court, and the judge basically went through each victim and asked him for details. What do you think brings these animals to want to get caught, like Dennis Rader did?
Well, you know, Rader, I think, was different from, say, Ted Bundy. Ted Bundy was a handsome, charismatic young man who went from the Pacific Northwest all the way down to Florida, killing as he went. And he just liked to be under the radar. He would often say that he had a broken arm or a hurt leg, and could the pretty woman help him by giving him a ride somewhere, and then boom, they were a victim. Rader, on the other hand, was a man who, let's see, he killed not nearly as many as Bundy or John Wayne Gacy. He only killed 10 people, but he strung it out from 1974 to 1991. And he, I think, was motivated by wanting attention. He would write to the local newspaper. He would give them clues. He would say, do this to the police. Try to catch me with that little piece of evidence. And I think he was in it for the hunt, for the attention, and for the mystery, I think, that he thought he was creating. It was a game to him. For Bundy, I think it was a way of life, unfortunately, like so many other serial killers we see.
When you see a case like what's happening now in the Los Angeles area, targeting the homeless, the cases in the past targeting prostitutes, street people, for lack of a better term, where do you think the motivation comes for a serial killer to choose their victims? Like you say, with Bundy, he had a certain set that who he was looking for, makes it interesting for the investigators and the profilers to try and catch these guys. But why do you think they're going after the homeless, just because they're an easy target?
Well, there's some tie there. You know, Ted Bundy, for example, he was active in political campaigns where a lot of young, pretty women worked. And I would hazard a guess that probably some young, pretty woman did him wrong one time, and that was it, and
yeah,
that made him snap, and boy, he was going to go after every young, pretty woman he could. So for the homeless killer, they think they may have a suspect. I'm not sure that they have the right person, but I hope they do. I think perhaps this person, there's some tie there, Dana. I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but there's got to be a reason why this killer is so enraged by homeless people. Maybe they were homeless. Maybe their parents were homeless and forced them to be homeless as kids. Maybe they've worked very, very hard in their life, and they can't imagine why anybody would be homeless, because, boy, you should work as hard as I did. There's some psychological tie as to why someone would target the weakest of the weak among us, you know? It's like, why does a pedophile target a little child?
Right.
Because they can.
Yeah.
And it sometimes is just as easy as that, because the homeless are there, they're laying on the street asleep under a piece of cardboard, and it's easy to kill them, and I want to kill.
Yeah, for sure. Diane Diamonds here. The mental health system itself, and I slam them every chance that I can. I'm not saying they don't do a good job, but they're not doing a good enough job. When we have these individuals, a lot of them have been part of the home or the mental health system, but have been let back into society. I know that sounds terrible, but let's tie in the mental health system that we have today and what they could be doing differently to keep some of these characters from killing.
You know, that's such a good question. That is such a good question. You know, as a young reporter, I worked in New York, and I was assigned to New Jersey. And there was an area called Asbury Park, New Jersey, and they had a big mental institution there. And at one time, may I say this, the do-gooders decided, why is everyone locked up in this mental institution? Let them out, these poor people. And they gave them 2 or 3 months' worth of medication, and they said, goodbye, go try your luck at life, good luck to you. And a couple of years later, there was a study that so many of them had turned to crime because they had no other way of surviving. And they weren't in full faculty. And so I think a lot of it is a mental problem. Now, all these years later, why don't we know how to deal with that? I don't have the answer.
Yeah.
I think it's just such a complex answer, and it goes from person to person, and you know what the person went through as a child, or what kind of chromosomal damage they have in their body, or you know, I just don't know. I wish we would dedicate more crime and justice money to try to figure this out, because when you take serial killers, and my other pet peeve, serial rapists, who if we would just test all the DNA rape kits, we maybe could get many of them off the street.
Yeah.
If we could figure out the brains of serial rapists and serial killers, these are not people who stop at one victim. They could have dozens and dozens and dozens of victims each. We would reduce the crime rate in the world by, I can't even hazard a guess,
yeah.
But I don't know. I don't know why we haven't figured it out yet. I think because we just haven't dedicated ourselves to do it.
Yeah, for sure. Investigative reporter Diane Diamonds here. Probably two of the most hated yet popular listened to shows that I've done over the years, Diane, have been with Drew Peterson. At I interviewed his lawyer, Joel Brodsky, earlier today. I'm going to play it a little bit later on, and I wanted to talk to you a little bit about Drew and what's going on with him and his case. Now, most recently, there was a Lifetime movie. I didn't see it. I've seen parts of it on the internet talking about his case and portraying Drew. And actually, both sides have gone public. The Peterson and Savio family, and Drew himself, and said it was a bunch of nonsense. And one of the questions I asked Joel Brodsky today was how he thinks that movie will affect jury selection and the case itself. Let's talk about that a little bit. Besides Drew Peterson coming out with a TV movie about a case that's still before the courts, is that right?
You know, my human being hat on, I say, no, it's not.
Right.
Because where in the world in America could you go to pick a jury that wouldn't be tainted? But I'm not for censorship. And I keep getting flashes of the Casey Anthony case.
Sure.
While you're asking me this question, because where in the world could you have gone to get a jury that could sit on the Casey Anthony case that hadn't heard about it in the state of Florida, for goodness sake? Well, they did pick a jury, and the jury found her not guilty, much to my surprise as I sat in the courtroom there. But, I think you can get an impartial jury, but here's the rub, Dana. I think when you get an impartial jury, you get an uninformed jury. You get a jury that, A, doesn't know anything about current affairs. They don't pay attention to the news. They don't understand the current human dynamic. They don't understand that there are people like Drew Peterson in the world who can have a wife who died mysteriously, have a second wife who now he's accused of killing, and put that into any perspective.
Yeah.
You know, I think that uninformed juries today, these jurors that we try to pick that have never heard of a case, they are looking for a reason to say, I don't think he's guilty. I don't think she's guilty. You didn't prove it like they prove it on CSI on television.
Exactly.
I didn't have any DNA to prove when Kaylee Anthony died. I'm not going to have any proof to prove when Drew Peterson's wife died. I think that we've gotten skewed in the country on these things, and it's too bad, but I don't think it's the media's fault. The media's job is to put the information out there, whether it's news or a movie or a play or a song or whatever it is, but it's up to the rest of the population to be smart enough and informed enough and common sense thinking enough to come to a good verdict.
Yeah, so true.
That makes sense.
Diane Diamond's here. Absolutely. And the reason I asked that, and I asked that of you because I respect your opinion for as many years as you've been in the business, it now goes to the case itself, the Peterson case, when it goes to trial. Brodsky figures in the next 3 to 4 months after the hearsay evidence ruling comes out and all that. But now it looks like there will be cameras in the courtroom. And Joel Brodsky, probably one of the first interviews, even before Drew was arrested, they were both on the program, and I asked him the question, if Drew is arrested and there is a trial, how are you going to handle this? And Brodsky said he is going to do as much media as he can and use an O.J. Simpson-style defense, as much media as he gets. He loves the idea of cameras in the courtroom. It'll be interesting. The folks, you'll just have to stay tuned to see what Brodsky says when I ask him that question today. But your thoughts about cameras in the courtroom, and here we're going to have another high-profile case, and I'm sure you'll be there covering it.
Oh, I hope I am. You know, I'm doing a lot of work now for Newsweek and the Daily Beast, and they sent me down to do the Casey Anthony trial and whatnot. So, and we're looking at the Sandusky trial now up in Pennsylvania. They may be changing venue on that. But I would love to cover the Peterson trial, mostly because I haven't been that connected to it. I've watched it, of course, but I like to go into trials where I don't think I know everything. And I want to sit and, you know, convince me. Both sides convince me. But back to cameras in the courtroom, again, at its face, I'm not for censorship. And I think cameras in the courtroom are great tools to teach the public about our crime and justice system. I mean, I worked for Court TV for many years. And how many court trials did we highlight in a very sedate way? We were not obtrusive. We put a camera in the courtroom, one or two or three cameras, and we just broadcast it and let the public decide what they decided. But they got to see the system at work. Here's the problem. Johnny Cochran and the "if the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit." And Brodsky, what is he going to do? He loves the media. He's going to play to the camera. Jose Baez did it. I watched him do it in the Casey Anthony case. He knew that camera was in that courtroom, and he would raise his voice and, you know, this indignation, and, oh, it was like a Perry Mason moment. So I think the more that we – that's the long answer to – this is the long way of my answering your question – I think the more that we televise these things, the smarter jurors get to the tricks. Because on the face of it, I will admit a little bias, I think the prosecutor is there to tell you the facts. They're not allowed to speak to the media. They're not allowed to do anything sensational. The defense attorneys are there to play to the cameras, to make it up, to try to trick jurors into thinking their way, or at least thinking, ooh, I have reasonable doubt. And so when you bring the cameras in, you shine sunlight on that. And you make the informed person see, oh, look what they're doing. They're taking me down a path they shouldn't even be taking me. That's speculation. That's not even the truth. That's a lie. And I think if the jurors in the Casey Anthony case had been more informed to defense tricks, they would have realized that, starting with the opening statement, Jose Baez just told them bullshit lies.
Yeah.
That he never, ever came back and gave any proof about. So I'm all for the cameras in the courtroom because I think they reveal the scallywags among us.
And, you know, I asked Jeff Ashton when I interviewed him a couple of weeks back that same question about cameras in the courtroom, and he didn't really care one way or the other. He would have done things the same way. But I guess when you have those 12 and two alternates, it could go either way. Diane, I'll give you the last word here. With the Peterson trial on the horizon, and like you say, Sandusky and everything else that's out there, is the public ever going to grow tired of this? Because I don't think so. I think there's going to be more and more of these cases, sadly, and everybody loves to look at them.
You know, I take it back to biblical days. And what was the most interesting stuff that you learned in Bible school? It was about all those people who did things wrong.
That's right.
You know, we enjoy watching the criminal or the suspected criminals among us because, oh my gosh, we would never think to do that. I would never think to put my child in a trunk and maybe give her chloroform. And I would never think to take my wife, with Peterson's third wife, and do away with her and maybe put her in a barrel and have my brother-in-law help me carry her body away. It is the mystery. It is the soap opera of criminal stories that so captivate us. And, you know, honestly, it's what keeps me going every day because I can't believe some of the stuff I learned about human nature. I don't think we're ever going to learn, lose our curiosity about it.
Absolutely. Diane, it's always a pleasure. Diane's webpage, dianediamond.net. Make sure and check out her article, America's Serial Killers, How Many? Thank you, as always.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's Diane Diamond, and make sure and check out her webpage. We're going to come back with another update. We want to stay on top of the Kesey story as much as we can with our crime blogger, Blink from Blink on Crime, and Jennifer Kesey's dad, Drew. So Drew Kesey and Blink will be here to update the disappearance of Jennifer Kesey here on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. Even before my Scared Monkeys days, when I hosted my show on another network, I talked about and covered this story, the disappearance of Jennifer Kesey. And it's a story that it's hard to believe. It's over 6 years old now. And it's a story that we need to get answers to. Drew Kesey and his wife have been guests on my program many times. We've had Blink, our sister blogger, on the show many times to talk about it. We've talked about the evidence. We've done everything possible that we can. Now it's the public's turn to do something possible to help us out here. Drew Kesey, Blink, welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you, Dan. Appreciate it greatly.
Drew, it's been a while since I've had you on. We'll get to Blink in a minute. I know our last program, you weren't able to come on. I totally understand that. You have had a chance to listen to it. If you could, just update the audience a little bit on what's been going on with the investigation regarding your daughter's disappearance.
Sure. And I thank you for understanding my absence. Jennifer's case, after 6 years, is incredibly still very active. We are very fortunate, I think, to have a change at the top of Orlando Police Department one more time again. Chief Paul Rooney has taken the reins. I think it's about 5 months now, and we've had the opportunity to meet with him, actually, I think on his second day of duty as chief, and he is out of the SWAT area of OPD, and he is a true leader, and he's a true man of his word, and things are being shaken up in Orlando right now on not only Jennifer's case, but obviously, Dana, there's a lot of cases in Central Florida. It seems to be a hotbed. And I think Orlando finally got a man that needs to do the job, knows how to do the job, and is willing to do the job. But many things have happened with Jennifer. We've gone through probably the biggest search since she was gone, just, I guess, 2.5 weeks ago. And we did not know anything about the search. I was actually awoken at 7:30 a.m. in the morning by a call from our lead detective that said we are on the ground and we are going. And honestly, I said, okay, hung up the phone and went back to sleep, only to be awoken by many calls and made aware of the size of the search.
Right.
We came up empty again. But I think that avenues are starting to open up. And I thank the community for staying with us. I thank you. I mean, you've been there the whole time. You know it. And then Blink has done some incredible work all around this country. And you know, behind the scenes, I didn't even know she was kind of working for Jennifer. And she does incredible work too.
Drew, when you look at dedication and you look at a group of people wanting to get answers, I hate that term closure because something like this is never closed, but getting answers for the family is the main thing. And I'm going to ask Blink, since we've had you on the show last time, there's been a lot of talk, a lot of conversation. It's interesting to see, and I'm certainly not taking any credit for this, but it's interesting to see. I think we've opened up some media's eyes once again by starting to talk about the case because it's starting to get talked about even more so. What has changed since last week, Blink?
Well, to what Drew said, everything that is progressing in Jennifer's case is absolutely the credit of her family, of Drew, Joyce, and Logan. These are people that have, in their dogged pursuit, have done nothing but make sure that, you know, every drum is beaten, every tree is shaken. So I would give them the credit, of course. But since we last spoke, and Drew's exactly correct, I think that Chief Rooney, his commitments to not just the Kessie family, but, you know, the community at large, he is not one to fail that office, and it is a priority to solve this case. I believed him then, and I believe him now. The SMART team that was put in place, the 19 individuals that we talked about, are the creme de la creme of investigation, but the fact is they only have, you know, what they have to work with. So since we have spoken last, we were able to develop a witness that came forward, has been polygraphed, passed that polygraph, and there is some serious concern about a coworker of Jennifer's by the name of Johnny Campos. And we did talk about him briefly, I think, in our last interview. Since that time, it seems that in our investigation and in our research, we keep hitting upon things that are coming back to Jennifer's employment at Central Florida Investments. And what we came up with, which may or may not be directly related to her, but it certainly speaks to, you know, the climate, if you will, is right around this time, there was significant business dealings with a bunch of folks in the real estate venture that actually ended up under federal indictment for a Ponzi scheme of over $20 million. And as we are researching, I think some of the information that we have withheld so far that we are, you know, we're fact-checking and verifying to see if it's relative to the case before we say, well, what about this, what about this, it's becoming clear to me that that was a very big issue right around the time of the, you know, the real estate bubble pretty much bursting in that environment. We're going to see significant, I mean, just a mess. We're going to see some of the names that, if you can, this is a big thing to talk about before I release it, but we're going to see some names that we saw in the beginning of the Casey Anthony case that are very concerning to me in the climate of this.
Wow. Blink from Blink on Crime is here, and Drew Kessie's here talking about the disappearance of Jennifer Kessie. Drew, with the SMART team put together now, the creme de la creme of investigators, as Blink like to say, and the conversations that you and I have had over the years about the investigation and other work that you have done as far as the missing and crime and justice in Florida, so to speak, when you look at the media and you look at how the media have covered cases like your daughter's and Casey Anthony, and I could go on and on and on, has the media done enough when it comes to these cases? Because sometimes they'll grab one case like Anthony and go 73 shows with it, and there's five others or 15 others that may have liked that airtime too. What would you like to see as far as the media and how they handle cases like this?
Well, first off, I don't have one bad thing to say about the media. They have treated Jennifer and us with nothing but pure dignity. What has been coming out lately is that, you know, why are certain cases getting the attention? And it's been that way for, honestly, let's put it, it's been that way for 6 years. You know, we look at the pretty blue-eyed blonde syndrome, the whole bit.
Right.
Folks, I am honestly here to tell you that that has nothing to do about anything. What has to do about it is the unconditional love that a family is willing to go through, willing to expand, willing to generate, to find their loved one. Joyce and I and Logan have said it many, many times. Personally, we are intimidated by no one or no situation any longer. We have huge mouths, and you must use them. And we were accused just this week in Orlando that, you know, a woman, Loretta Rogers, her daughter is missing 2 years, and why does Kessie and Ocasio get a lot of attention? Well, I wish out of the 100,000 on any given day in America, I wish every single parent would be loud.
Yeah.
And would stand up for their child. But I understand that some of them can't, and I understand that some are in the what we call banishment and true stranger abduction that Jennifer is in. But, you know, you have to speak up. I and her family are the biggest advocates for Jennifer.
Yep.
And if you don't do it, no one will. And I urge anyone who has a missing person within their family to scream as loud as they can from the mountaintops and do whatever they can. And if they are unable to do that, I feel sorry for, you know, I do feel sorry for them. But we as a family have that dedication, unconditional love, and I think we're fortunate to have had the ability to sustain.
And that's so important. And Blink, when you hear Drew answer that question, and I may not have phrased it properly, but he knew what I was talking about because we've gone through this many times, him and I. When you look at that and you look at these cases and how you cover them on your blog and how we cover them here on the show or at Scared Monkeys or wherever, do you think law enforcement, the investigators themselves, maybe even the mainstream media, take us seriously? Because, gol darn it, they should.
Well, I know they do. They absolutely do. And it's part of their job, really, to look at avenues that are exposed, whether that's via our work or other, you know, there's not a lot of we talked about this before, there's not a ton of investigative reporting to be done. But again, I'm going to commend the Kessies because going through the process to address Jennifer's case, as we just did, it's brutal for them. I mean, how many hours of phone calls, you know, with me and how many emails back and forth and dredging up, you know, 6 years of information is brutal to someone, and they don't balk.
Right.
But that's critical in developing, you know, as I said to Drew in the very beginning, you need to treat me like I don't know anything about this case, and I'm going to treat you that way. So I'm probably going to ask you things you've been asked 100 billion times. Not one time did he ever balk. He answered everything, and knows this case and knows her, you know, ins and outs, Jennifer's ins and outs, like I've never seen. I mean, there's a whole, they understand the information that's necessary. And as Drew said, and they're going to see this through. One of the things that struck me about Jennifer's case in particular when you talk about covering it is, for us, we need to, if we're going to engage the public to have this be top of mind, to jog their memories and to discuss it, that's really the way this works. We need to have something with some teeth, and that means that we've got to go over all of this stuff and develop, hopefully, new information, and that is critically helpful to law enforcement. They're not always going to say, hey, and some of them do, don't get me wrong, but they're not always going to say, hey, you know, great that, you know, we got this from this, and that, but it doesn't even matter.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
As Drew has said to me in the past, I really don't care, you know, how this gets solved, I just want it solved.
Yep.
And that struck me from the beginning of Jennifer's case. This is a solvable case, period, in my mind. It absolutely is.
You know, and you're right. It doesn't matter. Nobody deserves credit in a situation like this.
Right.
We deserve answers. The family deserves answers. And, Drew, I'll ask you this. An investigation is putting the pieces of the puzzle together. That's a simple investigation 101. Some of those pieces of the puzzle, without getting into specifics, in my opinion, may have been missed early on. Some of those pieces of that puzzle are starting to come out now. Are you starting to feel confident that maybe this puzzle will eventually be solved?
Yes, I do. For the first time in a very, very, very long time, I truly think that we maybe have the best chance that we've ever had to at least have an indication of what has happened to Jennifer. I mean, remember, you know, the FBI left us last year at she's vanished, we have no clue, please go away.
Yeah.
To now, you know, it's there. It's there. And I think Blink has said it to me, you know, I think many people have said it to me, that when it is all said and done, we're going to say, wow, how stupid. It was right in front of us.
Right.
And I truly do believe that now. But I think we have a better chance now with the people in place and the people that are so graciously helping us, that we have the best chance at this point, I believe.
Blink leadership begins at the top, and in investigations, you've covered them for years and so have I, sometimes multi-jurisdictional investigations, egos get in the way. Are you not seeing that now? You're seeing a cooperative, a cohesive group?
Drew choked me up for a second. I'm sorry. I thought I could regain myself before you asked the question. To hear hope by somebody from the family that's been in this situation for as long, it's staggering. But I agree. The moment I feel, you and I talked about this, there it gets a pulse of its own when a case starts with some serious traction, and I feel strongly that Jennifer's case does. So to hear that underscored was a good thing to hear. The egos, let's look at it this way. Do you think you can really put 19 people that basically do the same thing in a room and not get egos? Probably not.
No.
But I do believe that, and just to back up a second in something you had asked me about law enforcement, there are things that they know that I haven't published.
Yep.
In every case.
Sure.
There are some things nobody ever knows that go directly to a prosecution and things along those lines. So they're clear that we're not out to trump law enforcement. We're not out to point fingers, ever. We're out to find Jennifer and the person or persons responsible for what happened to her. That is our only goal. We work for her. So there's never a time where certainly our egos come into play. I think that has been a problem in this case in the past. I think there is no room for it with the exposure that it's got right now and the momentum. I'd be hard-pressed to see how anybody could formulate ego with, you know, the family looking at them saying, look, you know, we're gracious enough to kind of look past some of the things that have happened. Now let's get to work. We need to accomplish this. I feel better about this case than I ever have. to echo Drew's sentiment.
Drew, last question, and I do appreciate your time tonight.
I appreciate the time, believe me.
Many Christmases have passed, birthdays, family gatherings. There's that empty chair, that missing smile, that beautiful young girl that was part of your life but is always still going to be part of your life. What does the Kesey family want as a, again, I hate that term closure, but as a conclusion to this case?
I think we simply want to know what has happened to Jennifer, for the good or the bad. We don't need to know, I don't think, really specifics. I mean, I think you will find that out anyhow. That is not necessary to us. I think that we just need to know what happened to Jennifer, and we celebrate her every day. She is never, I mean, I'm looking at a picture of her, my favorite picture, and she's 3 years old. It's black and white. People think, okay, Jennifer Kesey was taken at 24. Well, you know, we all had incredible 24 years with Jennifer, and we've had more years than many people that are missing and taken, and they will never wane. Her brother's getting married this summer. It's we're not the only ones.
Yeah.
It's just that she's ours, and she needs to come home. She deserves to come home. I think she would have had the opportunity to come home sooner if things were done properly. But again, we have to look past that and say, this is where we are. And again, I think we're at our best chance that we've ever had in finding at least what happened to Jennifer. But that's all we're asking for, is just give me a chip or give me her that says, yep, that's Jennifer Kesey. And we will accept either.
And yeah, absolutely. Click on the show notes to get to Jennifer's webpage and Blink's page. Blink, I'm going to give you the last word.
I'm going to ask, first of all, I'm going to thank the public, both on my site, Scared Monkeys, on the Find Jennifer Jennifer Kesey site, and folks that are interested in this case, that if you know anything, you know the way to get in touch with those folks. This investigation is progressing. I am interviewing new people on a daily basis. More than one person knows what happened to Jennifer, and as is so frequently the case, the time to be heard is now. So I would ask for that courageous individual. We do have bilingual editors. We will make accommodations that are necessary. It's time, and I'm asking for Jennifer's family, for Jennifer, for all of their sakes, to come forward and help us bring Jennifer home.
Amen to that. Drew and Blink, thank you.
Thank you. Good night, Dana.
Most humble to both of you, and well, really thank you for being there. For so long and continuing. It is.
We will cover this story until answers are obtained. Thanks, folks. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
That's Drew Kesey and Blink from Blink on Crime. And boy, I tell you, every time I talk to Drew Kesey, Blink got a little emotional. And this old, tough, grizzly cop. It gets a little emotional, too, when I think about this case and think about all the others. We don't do this just to blather on and on and on. We're actually here to try and help, and now it's the public's turn to try and help. It's so important. Joel Brodsky. Who's Joel Brodsky? Well, I talked about him with Diane Diamond. He's Drew Peterson's lawyer. Two of the most hated interviews, the interviews I got the most hate mail for were my Drew Peterson interviews many years ago. Drew Peterson's been in custody 1,000 days, effective today. That's hard to believe. 1,000 days he's been in custody, and he still hasn't gone to trial yet. Most recently, Lifetime Entertainment had a movie about Drew Peterson. I think Rob Lowe played Drew Peterson. Lots in the media about it. Lots in the media about cameras in the courtroom for the Peterson case. It will be another high-profile case like you'd never believe. So I thought I'd go out to Joel Brodsky, Drew Peterson's attorney, and see what he had to say. Okay, we're back. You all know Joel Brodsky. He's the attorney for Drew Peterson. I thought I'd bring Joel on to talk about this dopey Lifetime movie that was on and get some updates as far as what's happening with the case. Joel, welcome back to the show.
Oh, my pleasure to be back.
Nice to have you. It's been a while. We'll get to Lifetime in just a minute or two, but I'd like to get an update from you as far as what's happening. Lots of talk about cameras in the courtroom, the hearsay evidence. Haven't had you on the show for a while, so let's talk about that.
Okay, well, I guess the first question is what's the status of the case? We are waiting for a ruling from the appellate court here in Illinois, the Third District Appellate Court. We had won before them the first time. The state appealed to the Supreme Court of Illinois. Supreme Court of Illinois punted it back to the appellate court, and we're waiting for them to give us a ruling on the hearsay. And as soon as we get that, we're probably about 2 to 3 months from trial once we get that decision. And that decision could come down tomorrow. It could come down in a month. It's no way to tell. We hope it comes sooner because we really like to get this case to trial. Drew is, as actually today is, well, the day I'm talking to you on the 31st is the 1,000th day that Drew has been in jail.
Wow.
He's been in jail 1,000 days of January 31st.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like that long. Now, this ping pong match between courts, how does that affect the ultimate outcome? Because, you know, if there's a conviction, there's a possibility of appeal, all the sort of stuff. What do you do as a lawyer to prepare when you're not really sure what's going to be admissible and what isn't?
Well, we're fortunate in a little bit different perspective here. We were ready to go to trial on July 8th of 2010, when the case was originally set to go. That's the date the state appealed, you know, less than, you know, 12 hours before the case was set, the trial was set to start. The case is, I mean, the movie business, and we're talking about movies in a few seconds.
Yeah.
The movie business, they call it in the can. You know, the movie's in the can?
Yeah.
Our defense is, our case is in the can. We have everything ready to go. It's just a matter of figuring out if we have to address any other hearsay issues, and pulling out the what you call the trial book, the witness books, you know, brush them off, and reread them, refresh our recollections, and go to trial. My team, I've talked to them. We could be prepared and ready to go in less than 14 days, if necessary. So we can get all the experts, you know, lined up and in the town. So. We're fortunate. Most guys that have to deal with appellate issues haven't been that close to trial, and so we're fortunate that we're really prepared. There may be if the hearsay ruling goes against us, we may have to address one or two or three new witnesses, but you know, we can handle that. It's not a big deal.
What about cameras in the courtroom? Lots of talk.
Yeah, isn't that something? Illinois. This is, I guess. Drew Peterson case has been a lead case in a lot of ways. It was the first case where there were cameras allowed in the courtroom in the appellate court argument, and now it's probably going to be the first trial case in Illinois history that's going to be tried. But the Supreme Court of Illinois has now said that cameras could be in the courtroom. The chief judge of Will County has said that he's okay with that, so he got his approval. And just a matter of somebody asking. And I believe that some of the networks have already started hiring lawyers to get permission from the Will County courts to broadcast the Drew Peterson case live as it happens.
As a defense attorney, and I know I've asked you this question before, cameras in the courtroom, we look at Casey Anthony most recently, and of course going back to OJ, does that work in your favor or against you?
Well, I don't know that it really matters to us at all. The real audience that we're concerned about are the 14 jurors, the 12 jurors, a couple alternates, so 14 or 18 people that are sitting in the jury box. That's the audience that matters to us. You know, there might be some less experienced lawyers that may play to a camera that's in the courtroom, but the team that I put together with myself and Joe Lopez and Steve Greenberg and Ralph Metchek and Dale Goldberg of we counted up that we've had between that team over 500 jury trials, over 150 jury murder cases. So I have a very, very experienced team. We're not going to, our crowd presentation isn't going to vary one whit if it was one spectator or a million. We're going to put on the same trial, and we're going to show that jury that there is absolutely no evidence that Drew Peterson had anything to do with Kathy Savio's death, that it was a tragic household accident.
The Lifetime movie, Joel, and I know there's been some press reports already that not only your side, but the other side have said that it was just a bunch of nonsense, for lack of a better term. How do you see that affect this trial, or will it?
Well, I mean, we've already had to work on our jury questionnaire, or, you know, the jurors are going to have to fill out a questionnaire as we pick them, to add questions about whether or not you watched the jurors have watched a movie, or had a family member that's watched a movie, or things of that nature. And we're working on that as we speak, actually. And it's obviously going to complicate the task of picking a jury. It may, depending on how many people in Will County or the area around Chicago have watched the movie, may make it impossible to pick a jury here. I don't know. Well, I believe what they're going to try to do is attempt to pick a jury here, and if we go through 200 jurors and we can't do it, we may have to move the case. But it's really going to complicate the issue, and it wasn't necessary. And it could have waited. If they wanted to profit off this case, the network could have waited. They could have waited until after the trial. I thought it was not only a flawed movie, movie that created events and out of whole cloth with no basis. It was so inaccurate, it was laughable. But not only that, but it was an attempt to profit, at the sake of somebody's right to a fair trial. And I just thought that, morally, it was morally wrong. Unfortunately, with the First Amendment, it wasn't legally wrong. But of course, once again, when Drew's acquitted, they may have to face a libel trial or a slander suit, but I thought that even to publish it was morally incorrect, even if it was accurate, and it wasn't, it would have been morally improper, because I think a person's right to a fair trial is much more important than a corporation's profit motive.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's just me, though,
Yeah, for sure. And what you see, the reviews, and actually from both sides, the factual inaccuracies outweigh.
Oh, my God. The factual inaccuracies were unbelievable. I mean, they put people that never have met interacting. They put events that never even alleged to have occurred, or conversations that were never even alleged to have occurred, they created. I mean, it was just out of whole cloth. It was absolutely ludicrous. But it's a story, and they want to make profit. I mean, it's Hollywood, right? They're there to make money.
Right.
It's a huge business, a huge industry.
Yep.
They don't, I hope that people understand that it's a Hollywood movie. It's entertainment. It's Lifetime Entertainment Network. If you look at their official title, it's entertainment. It's not meant to be a documentary. It's not, if people understand that and confine themselves to what evidence is presented in the courtroom, Drew Peterson absolutely will be acquitted. If they're going to convict somebody because they don't like them because of an entertainment movie, then there's a problem. But I have faith in jurors. I really do. I've seen enough of them. Been to enough jury trials that I think jurors are mostly conscientious and try to do a good and fair job and only convict or acquit based on the evidence. And if that's the case, I have no concerns.
All right. Joel Brodsky, always a pleasure, sir. I'll be in touch.
All right. Thank you so much.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye-bye. That's Joel Brodsky, attorney for Drew Peterson. Yeah, it'll be interesting. A lot of talk about the Lifetime movie, how it will affect. I think it might have a bit of an effect when it comes to jury selection, and will there be a change in venue? I don't know. It's hard to say. It'll be interesting, a story to watch for sure. Yeah, but what really needs to happen is answers for the Savio family, the Peterson family, and even Drew Peterson. Let's see how justice is served. I'm Dana Pretzer. This is Scaremonkeys Radio. We'll be right back. And I hope you enjoyed the show tonight. My thanks to all the guests and, of course, to you for listening, whether it's live, whether it's on Access Channel 7 or part of the podcast or however you pick up the show. We're here for you. We'll see you again real soon here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
Listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guests' websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.